Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save It for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community.
That was rough. It's supposed to be in the 80s next week. So
yeah.
Yeah. What did you say? You guys were like in the 30s the day before you got back?
Yeah.
That's like a shock to your system.
I could never figure out the
Celsius conversion.
I didn't even try. Like, yeah. They're like, oh yeah, it's cold. You know,
I had like several conversion like things on my phone, like on like, on the internet. So I just like toggle through like currency, time, or not time, but like, temperature.
Yeah. You have to do time to figure out reaching back out to the family, their stateside, and then you don't want to wake them up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We just figured if it's our afternoon, you know, 4 or whatever, it's going to be 11 or whatever in the morning. So always a good time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just wanted to welcome everybody back to another episode of Save for the Blind. Carson Odegaard, your normal co-host with Jeff Smith and a special guest, Colby Smith. They just got back last Saturday. Well, a couple Saturdays ago from when this episode will air, but got back from New Zealand and are going to share kind of the second half of the experience. We had Jeff on earlier talking about the first half when he was there in New Zealand. So we're going to kind of recap the second half and then both of their experiences and what they thought about it and how they felt it went. So welcome back to the States.
Yeah, good to be back. It's a lot different going into, you know, 90 to potentially 100 degree heat.
Yeah, you guys were in winter.
Yeah, I mean, and what's weird is I was, the last couple of days of our trip, I was really bundled up. You know, we have breathable waders, obviously, but I was wearing more layers than I normally would wear out on a cold day out here. And even wore gloves, which I don't really remember the last time I wore gloves.
Was it like a damp cold or was it just, because, you know, we get like the fog and then it gets colder. And then up here when it's sunny, it's like warm, even if it's 30 degrees.
Yeah, we're like back in this mountain range and the sun didn't hit you for a while, for like a couple hours, it seemed like. But it was really weird. I thought he called it a nor'western, but it was like the wind would shift very frequently and you would get these whiffs of really warm air and then it would be freezing cold.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that was our last couple of days. But I mean, we weren't super far away from the ocean too. But I wouldn't, it's not like it's a drier cold. It's not like a, you know, rice field, foggy, bone chilling cold. But definitely wasn't used to the weather change. But I mean, most of the people that we hung with, like they wear shorts under their waders and it's like not a big deal at all.
So they just wear shorts year round. No matter what.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, the climate's really like, you know, I'm going to compare it back to the Northeast zone, but like, it'd be like growing up there and a farmer is wearing shorts all year round. Like we were with a guy, I was like, you know, do you wear shorts all the time? And he was like, yeah, mate. I was like, it's freezing cold outside, you know? And they're working all the time, you know what I mean?
Even when so they're working.
Like, yeah. It's physical labor. It's like, oh, I don't really want to scrape my knee up on a bunch of rocks and stuff, but yeah
so interesting seeing anybody from like the timber industry to farmers just all like get out of their log truck and just be shorts and like that's wool socks on and just a little different to see, like, from especially from where we grew up.
I've never thought about, you know, some of the New Zealand folks that we've hosted. I don't think I've ever noticed them wearing shorts all the time, but I've just never asked them about what they thought about our weather, you know, in comparison, because it'll be interesting now when they send their next person out to see if notice them in shorts more. Because Jeff from 2 years ago, I don't feel like I noticed that a lot. I can't remember what the weather was like when he was out here, but it was January.
Yeah, but he, I think he just wore like a Drake jacket, and then when it rained, a shell. So he was mm-hmm. never like super bundled up. But it's like kind of half and half. Like some people, I think, are just short people, and then other people are wearing, you know, pants all the time, you know. But, you know, like the rancher or the farmer wearing shorts, you know, in the dead of winter is like, all right, good for you.
Do you feel like you packed adequately enough for your clothing, or do you wish you would have brought something else?
I didn't need anything else. I just wore some like a puffy or a little bit heavier stuff than I wore here, but I didn't think it was all that cold. Besides the wind, you know, when it was getting windy, that was the only time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I felt I packed everything. The first day that we hunted with Jeff on the North Island, it was so humid from the storm. I was like, wow, I way overpacked. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the last trip, I had an extra layer on that I normally don't have, and I was glad that I brought those items. But yeah, no, I mean, the one thing that I wish I would have researched just a little bit was like buying a Paradise Shell Duck call prior to going. And I'm not really sure why I did, because I could have bought one here for, you know, $30-$40. But over there, it's like over $100, which, you know, it's not still not bad in American dollars, but yeah. That was just something I wish I would have researched a little bit more.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later. I want to kind of go back to where we left off the last episode. You were on the side of a hill. I think you were still on the, correct me if I'm wrong, the North Island at that point, and you were headed to the South Island. So I want to talk about like the days after we talked last and what kind of hunt you did.
Yes, we were at a Gisborne, and that particular day we were up on this ranch trying to shoot pukekos, which is basically kind of like a larger coot that is purple in color, and they have a big shield like on the top of their forehead. Purple? Yeah,
like
yeah,
they're actually purple.
No, it's like purpley blue, right, Colb?
Yeah, I mean, looks black, right, when you look at it, but
yeah, okay,
yeah, and red and stuff, so it's pretty neat. And then yeah, so we were flying out in a day or two, so we went on one more Paradise Shell Duck hunt in a cut cornfield next to a vineyard and basically some other, you know, dairy ranches, and we had a really good afternoon hunt there, you know. And, and most of the prairie hunts that we were on, like you just show up at 12:30 or 1 and kick the birds off the field, and then they all just come back within the next hour and a half. And yeah, so we just basically set up underneath a tree and had some, you know, camo netting out in front of us, and we had a bunch of silhouettes, and yeah, basically they would circle or not circle and then come right into the silhouettes. And that was a pretty fun hunt. I enjoyed the Paradise Shell Duck hunting over probably anything that we did.
Is it common for them literally to come back to the same exact spot you bump them off of?
Do they
worry about like, oh, we bumped them and then they're going to go land, you know, it's like you snow goose hunt. They go land 300 yards away and then they just pile in there.
No, they just, well, some of them were wanting to land in the middle of the field, and that's where they all were. But we were on a side of the field that there was no Paradise Shell Duck sitting there, and we were, you know, the decoys were 15 yards off the fence line. But kind of what we've experienced with talking to everyone there was like, yeah, you'll bump the paris off and then they decoy so well, they'll go work the decoy spread, even if that's not exactly where they were in the field. Of course, there's a few of them that will land out in the middle of the field, but by the time you get another pair or two to decoy, you shoot and it bumps those other ones off the field. So, yeah.
That's interesting.
And then the day after that, we were flying out, and then we went out with one of the guests.
What's the flight time from the North Island to the South Island?
It was an hour and a half. So we had to fly from where we were at in Gisborne, and then we had to fly north to Auckland, and then we had to fly then south.
Oh, wow.
to the second island. Yeah. So like the airport that we flew out of, very, very small. I mean, you check in and the person checking the bags is also the person helping on the plane. And there's like no checking your luggage, nothing. You just show them your ticket.
That's old school.
Just get on the plane. And so then we went to Auckland to then fly to Nelson on the South Island. But we did get to go fishing right before we left to get on the plane. And we went snapper fishing out on the ocean. So on the beach, essentially, you walk out on these reefs that aren't really reefs, but you walk way out there as low tide and yeah, caught snapper, which are there like, you know, prized eating fish.
That's cool. So nice change of pace.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, I don't know. It just was beautiful scenery and there's no one else fishing. Like we drove along the coast for a while and no one fishing. And we got to the spot and we're like, do you ever see anyone fishing here? He's like, no, I've fished here for like 20 years and very rarely is there another fisherman here.
And it's a lot of public access stuff, at least for, we'll talk about hunting later, but like fishing, you could just like pull off the road.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, a lot of it, a lot of their waterways are, they're gaining more and more access for the public. But yeah, for the most part, yeah, you just walk and go and they'll have signs and stuff that will say like angler access off a road. So it's cool. Giving you access through private property to get to the place. They also have that for some of the, like their, what we would call like a big game unit or wildlife area.
Yeah.
Same type of thing where it's like a corridor where the public can walk and there's a parking lot and it says, you know, public access that someone can go up on a ridge or a mountaintop or whatever, but you do have to go, you know, through some private property to get there.
Gotcha. So you flew down to the South Island and then how'd it happen after that?
Yeah. So we got to Nelson and it started to rain really, really hard. And we had another like Pukeko hunt lined up and we talked to our host and we were like, hey, you know, if there's an opportunity to go big game hunting again, instead of the Pukeko hunt, you know, we would really enjoy that over doing that. So he made a phone call and yeah, we woke up in the morning and went off to this ranch, not too far away from his house, but it was pouring rain. So I guess the one thing I wish I would have brought was rain pants.
Mm, yeah.
That's the one thing that we did not bring, or like waterproof bibs or something like that. Cause we just basically hunted our waders all the time because everything's kind of wet and moist, so, or stickery. So you definitely get all that on your pants. So yeah, we hunted that morning and basically got drenched. Didn't see any animals on that hunt, but it was great.
Where were you guys going after?
Mostly pigs and fallow deer. So I had shot a red deer earlier in the trip. So we were trying to get Colby a fallow deer. And normally there's a bunch out there, but it was raining pretty good. So I think everything was tuckered in.
Gotcha.
So
from there, so you had the big game hunt that didn't work. What was after that?
Yeah. So we went from there and then we drove down to Blenheim. Was that the name of the town, Colby?
Yeah.
So we hunted with a guy named Guy. He's a retired doctor and he hunts out of a kind of a big estuary that goes out in the Tasman Sea area and took a mud boat out to the blind or the Mai Mai, which, you know, you don't see a lot of mud boats there.
Yeah, what kind of motor did it have?
It had a copperhead. And then they have another boat with a Go Devil long tail as well.
Classic.
But yeah, I mean, that entire area, lots of rivers and waterways that are, you know, open to the public. Saw a bunch of other Mai Mais, but same thing, like no one ever hunts them. They're kind of old. But yeah, hunted there and we shot their shoveler there. And we shot a few mallards. And but the coolest thing about that spot was there's a gray teal there that you cannot shoot. And it's bigger than our teal and it kind of looks like a, almost like a mix between a gadwall and like a hen sprig ish, you know? And they were just decoying in all day, like all the way till like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So fortunately we couldn't shoot any of those, but it was a very, very cool place to see that. And there was a bunch of swans and stuff in that area, but we didn't get any chances of those.
Do they ever have, I just imagine a bunch of teal coming in. I'm thinking about, you know, when we, like last season, you get one pintail, you shoot our pintail, and like there's a one widgeon in it. Do they ever get like a bird that flies in with the teal that they have to try to pick out?
Yeah, so that happened quite often where you could have two shovelers a person.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just like, teal, there's some more teal coming, and then you'd be like, boom, shoveler in the decoys. And you'd be like, oh no, and then it would get out of there. But the host had a set of binoculars, so if we saw some birds on a distance, we'd try to ID them before they ever got close to us. But yeah, I mean, they're coming in to, you know, right after each other type of a deal, but the teal were just kind of nonstop, always kind of coming around the decoys. But yeah, that was a really, really cool spot. Beautiful scenery. And I mean, you could pretty much like hear the waves and stuff and the surf.
That's cool.
That was pretty cool. But yeah, just basically no one else really hunting for the most part. And, you know, in that area, in the South Island, you can bait. You could bait with feeders and all that good stuff. Don't need a plug in your gun, which, you know, I think with the plugs in general, like, they're already far away by your third shot, so you're never going to have a fourth shot anyways, you know? Colby, we did have a goose hunt in between.
Yeah, I was going to say that, yeah.
Yeah, why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, so kind of interesting because, you know, kind of just roll up and you know, you're not seeing any geese. Just like there's a green field and there's like some ducks out there.
What time of day is this?
It's like dark almost. It's like 5 o'clock or something. You know, it's pretty late by the time we were setting up, you know, the decoys. We brushed the blinds real quick and it was like a fresh field. And they're really like, before they go goose hunting or even, they even talk about it when they parry hunt, which doesn't really matter in my opinion, but it didn't seem like, but like, they don't like putting tracks out in the field.
Interesting.
So we carried everything out. They didn't even really want us dragging the blinds because,
you know, the fear of hurting the crops or fear of like the birds seeing it.
Yeah. Birds. Yeah. Just the same birds getting hunted constantly. But anyways, we went out there with just, you know, a handful. I don't even know if it was maybe a dozen full bodies and set up real quick and kind of just waited for the, you know, geese. We heard there was a couple hundred in the field, you know, recently. And you could see they were out there. Got some ducks were kind of coming back into the field, but, you know, we weren't really set up in the right spot for them. And all of a sudden it's, you know, get close to dark and a big group comes in. I don't know if there was 100, you know, there might have been 50-ish or so, 40 to 50, but kind of didn't really land in the right in the spot, but kind of landed more on my side. And, you know, you're not allowed to like ground swat, you know, ducks there, but apparently geese you could, which you didn't really know until after we shot. But so anyways, we jumped up and we all got some shooting in. I think we ended up with 9 or 10. And then it was like dark. And they all had like spotlights with them that they, we were just waiting for another group to come in to hopefully, you know, kind of as they come in, spotlight them and do another volley, but it didn't really work out.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Kind of a cold canyon and it was like, it was starting to get pretty cold.
Huh. That's one of the things that we talked about on the drive home that you guys brought up to me, the differences in some of the stuff that they could do out here versus here. It's like, you can't shoot a duck on the water, but you can bait them.
That's in the rule books. Like you cannot shoot a duck.
Like if you told people that, like, hey, you could throw out as much corn as you want, but you're not allowed to shoot that duck on the water. People would be like, what?
Right.
Yeah. And you know, you cannot hunt out of a true pit blind. I think 2 feet of the blind, the upper top of the blind has to be exposed above ground level.
Yeah.
So that crazy. That type of stuff was definitely odd. And then, you know, you could use electronic calls, but for the most part, the The only time anyone ever uses an electronic call is sometimes when you're hunting Perry's, they have like a greeting call that sounds like a bunch of seagulls or something. And they come like right into that, or you just are on your call, your regular call. And it's like a, kind of like a soft duck, like ha 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 type of a sound.
Yeah.
But yeah. So that part of it was definitely different with the game laws. You can shoot lead still, but only if you're so many meters away from any water. They're definitely trying to phase that out. And then, you know, obviously shoot steel over water, but yeah.
So goose hunt, hunt in the bay, and then where'd you go from there?
Yeah, so we drove from... Where did we go?
We
went from Blenheim. We had a morning duck hunt, and then we were supposed to hunt Lake Ellesmere, which is like their historic big waterfowl area. If you could picture like Lambertville, but there is a huge lake there.
So like if you took all the Lambertville duck clubs and you just made it open water.
Yeah, but I mean, like the cabins and stuff at Lambertville.
Yeah,
you know, it's like that, and then there's a big pond or big lake behind it.
Yeah,
it's like Clear Lake size.
Wow, so big.
Yeah, big, and then it goes out into the ocean. But what had happened with that rain? It rose the lake level really high, and so they were worried about the lake flooding the farmland, right? So they go in there with a bunch of dozers and break the levee, and then just water just shoots out to the ocean, and then they dam it back up when they need to, but they hadn't dammed it back up. So the water level was really low, apparently. So we didn't get there till late. It was like a Tuesday night or something like that. So we weren't able to hunt that. And then basically, they thought the water level was too low anyways. So we didn't hunt that next morning either. So Lake Ellesmere, historically, you know, there'd be 40 to 50,000 black swans in that area. But I forget how many years ago, 15 years ago or something like that, there was a big storm that basically, there used to be a clear lake and now it's murky and muddy. And the swans eat this special type of vegetation that used to, you know, aquatic vegetation. And that storm basically wiped it out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so now there's only like 5 or 10,000 swans there. So it used to be like this metropolis of waterfowl hunting and fishing and like a huge culture, like everyone vacationed there. So now it's kind of on its downhill slide. You know, not a lot of people are living there and recreating like they once did, but you could still see like all the remnants of all the old blinds like way out there. But anyways, we went out there just to check it out, and there was like ducks and geese everywhere outside the parking lot. And
this is like a public lake. Like if you were up there, you could just launch a boat and go hunt.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And we're like, wow. You know, it was, at that point, that was the most birds we had seen all trip in one spot, because you just don't see very many birds just in general. Like you're not driving around and like, oh wow, there's a paddock with 1,000 ducks on it. Like there's not a lot of that going on. So yeah, we looked at that, super cool. We were kind of like, you know, it was like a ducky day. It was kind of windy and we're like, oh man, we, you know, it would have been nice to get out, but we're traveling further south after that. So we went home, packed up all of our stuff, and then we were on the road again, and we hunted from there, more like the picturesque, like what you think New Zealand looks like with the high peaks and the Lord of the Rings area and all that. So we went down into that country, and we hunted right off of the Pacific Ocean in like a little tidal pond, and a lot of mallards around. You know, but they just wouldn't finish and they're kind of acting finicky. And we shot a few. And then the very next day, we went up to, you know, basically those Highland peaks and hunted in a valley with like a braided river. So glacier water, clear, cold, nice rocks everywhere, but it was a huge braided river. I mean, nothing really to compare it to here. It was ginormous. And we hunted a little, you know, it'd be like almost like a little beaver pond, but it wasn't. And off of that big braided river. And we shot a bunch of mallards and paradise shell ducks. We shot a few. And then we're kind of wrapping it up. You know, it was kind of our last day to hunt. And our host went and talked to the farmer. And he was like, hey, there's been some paradise shell ducks down in this paddock. Let's go check it out. And, you know, we got up and we're like looking at the whole valley. And we're like, oh, there's some birds over there. There's some birds over there. And then we got to a field. And it probably had, I don't know, maybe 100 plus paries between these two fields. And it's like 11:30. And he's like, hey, you guys want to go for it? And we're like, yeah. You know, he's like, there's this fence line over here. There's some cover. We could sit down in that. And so basically set up the decoys really quick. And literally by the time we sat down and got loaded, they're already starting to come back. Yeah. And I think we shot or finished up, I don't know, 28 or something like that, or 26. And we shot for an hour and a half, maybe. And then once it's over, it's done. But
like once a lot of the birds come back, it's done. Like you're not seeing birds trafficking back and forth. It's like once the birds that you scared off come back, it's done.
Pretty much, yeah. So we went and had lunch and right outside of the field and packed up all of our stuff. But yeah, the paries. One, they decoy really well. They're vocal. They do respond to a call well, but they're a hard bird to bring down. Like, they're tough.
It's like shooting a golden eye.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, it's bigger than a cackler.
It's like a scoter, but in a field.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's a big, huge duck. Size of a goose, I mean, probably some of them are the size of a smaller speck, you know, but they're tough. I mean, if they're not decoying right in and, you know, if you had like a 25 yard shot and it's passing, you better bring it down with your first shot or you're shooting two more into it, you know?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So that was the last hunt you guys had before you had to pack up and head back?
Yeah, that was it. And that was probably, you know, kind of not necessarily saving the best for last, but scenery wise, you know, there's probably not too many places in the world that you'll have that type of scenery while you're duck hunting. It was, you know, snow on the mountain peaks, birds decoying really well. Never heard another gunshot.
Yeah.
You know,
you could literally like spot tar from like sitting in like shooting.
Bears. Yeah.
Like, oh, that's so cool.
I mean, we didn't really spend much time doing that, but you could.
That's,
yeah.
That's amazing.
And the valley kept going. So, I mean, you know, I don't know where we were at, but we could have kept driving and probably find just as many spots. But, yeah, like we kind of mentioned before, it's, you know, 90% of their duck hunters only hunt on opening weekend.
That was one of the questions I had for both of you is like, now that you've been there, what do you see as the difference between folks that duck hunt New Zealand compared to like the California duck hunter?
Yeah, I'll let you ride with that, Colb.
I think they a lot of those guys even mentioned it. It's like they it's kind of more of just a cultural, you know, we all go out as friends for opener, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Kind of, you know, once a year thing. And then there's those guys that are diehard that just that's what they do, you know. They might go shoot a deer or two, but you know, they hunt majority of the 3 week season that they might have in a certain area.
Yeah. And I think you told me when I had picked you guys up, which makes sense. Like one, say you got a 3 week season, so it's not that enticing to be a big time duck hunter because you can only do it for such a short time. But if the limit where you guys were say 25 or 50 and you got five guys and you go out in the opener and you kill 125 birds, like, yeah, I'm good. I don't need to do it again. Yeah. Like, so be it.
Our hunt program is still accepting applications for spring hunts. Visit calwaterfowl.org to apply today. While you're there, don't miss our membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Realtree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for waterfowl conservation. Upcoming events are Danville Banquet, June 23rd, Oakdale Banquet, June 24th, North Delta CWA Joint Fun Shoot at Bird's Landing, June 29th.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of the mentality is you have a couple great shoots and, you know, other than that, because I mean, you know, I don't, and we're speculating here, but I'm assuming like in that last zone that we're at, that you could shoot 50 mallards per day if you wanted to. But, you know, probably other than the opening day, it's probably pretty darn far out of reach. Because you're shooting just, the birds don't necessarily migrate. They're fairly local. So, you know, I think once you shoot at them pretty good for a day or two, they kind of go find those areas, just like at home where they're not going to necessarily move off of those. And, you know, a lot of people are eating or hunting for meat, and it might be like, hey, it might not be worth my time to go shoot 6-7 ducks or something like that too. I don't know, but you definitely have those diehard waterfowlers just like at home that it's, they're all about duck hunting. And I could see why. I mean, if you did not hunt on opening day, you probably would never see another group of hunters for the season. And where we were at, I think the season's like 2.5-3 months on that south piece. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like where we started with Jeff, it's like 4 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever it is. I mean, super short. But yeah, I mean, pretty wild. I mean, I like going into it, not that I thought we would see a lot of ducks, you know, but like we were hunting ducks in places like you probably would never even think to hunt here. Like in a small little valley with a little pond up next to a hill that's just a, you know, small, you know, think of
rapid. Yeah, with timber and stuff.
Yeah. And there might be 10, 15, 20 ducks on it that's kind of their home. And you go and hunt that place and you might only hunt it once a season, but there's a blind on it and well brushed and all that. And then they just kind of move around to kind of keep their hunting consistent. You know, and I could see why people bait, because if you aren't feeding them, there's really no reason for them to be there because there's other places for them to go. But they're, you know, what was interesting is like when they call their paddocks or their fields, it's just a grass field. Like the cows are eating it.
Not and
they
ag, might, just literally grass.
Yeah, I mean, they have cornfields, but there wasn't a ton that we saw that like were recently harvested. So they had been harvested and kind of sitting, and there wasn't really a ton in those. But as you could tell, like once they harvest the corn, it's pretty much game on that spot shortly after. But yeah, I mean, they think the ducks are going into the fields to basically eat, you know, worms and things like that. I mean, we shot a couple ducks. It was like mud all up in their bill, you know, and I don't know what they were eating, but they were super, super muddy, you know.
Something you see in the Delta.
Yeah. So, I mean, it kind of goes to what they think is, you know, why they're out in these fields, but it's just a regular field. It's not like a freshly planted alfalfa field where they're eating small shoots. It's a grass field.
There's grazing. You know,
they're just grazing.
It's like our geese in March.
Yeah. Yeah. So that part of it was different for sure.
What about the decoy museum you guys visited? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean,
pretty cool. That guy had some amazing stuff I've never seen before. Just boxes of shells from other countries was some of the most impressive part of it.
Yeah. He had like walls and walls of boxes of shotgun shells.
So it was just a guy in New Zealand that's established kind of like a legacy collection.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically he was collecting and then people essentially heard that he was collecting and they're like, hey, you know, my father died and here's all the decoys. And then he would figure out who the father was and who he hunted with. And kind of get all the history behind the decoys. Because a lot of stuff there, you know, it's handmade by folks. Like we hunted Paradise Shell Ducks over some shells that were made 40 years ago by a father and son team, right? So a lot of the stuff in the museum was, you know, native to New Zealand with their types of woods and their interpretation of ducks. And just like we'd see here in California in, you know, the early 20s, et cetera. Same type of deal. They've got some famous people that, you know, probably their decoys are worth more than others. But yeah, he basically had this huge shop just filled with calls, decoys, old blind stools, all the boxes of shells from all over the world. Little boat skiff setups with like decoys on the boats, just like you would see here kind of in the market days. There was a decoy there from 1915 that was a duck with a jerk cord on it, and it had two pegs on the side of it. So when you pulled the jerk cord, the wings rotated. So you would shoot a duck and then put the bone in the little circle. Yeah. And then the wings would rotate. So like you think of original Mojo or whatever, yeah. It's kind of like that. And there's only two known, and we saw both of them while we were there, which was pretty cool. Yeah. But just a collector. So we're sitting there and there's a gentleman there with his wife talking to the owner, and they're talking about, you know, clays and target shooting and all that good stuff. And then he's like, "Hey, where are you guys from?" We're like, "Oh, California." He's like, "Oh, I work at Wing and Barrel."
What?
And we're like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah. I'm leaving in a couple of weeks. I go out there for a month or two, and then I come back home." We're like, "Wow, small world there." Yeah. So he does all like the professional training and sets up the courses and stuff.
No
and
way. Like,
how would we meet someone that works at Wing and Barrel in the middle of nowhere, New Zealand?
That's
at this
wild.
Awesome, no you know, duck shop. Yeah.
Yeah, you kind of talked about when you were talking about the Perry call, the cost of hunting and how potentially expensive it could be out there because of having to import everything. What did you say? You went to the store and the pack of decoys was like $100 for like two or something like that?
Yeah, so there was two, you know, it's a Avery brand, but there was two Shoveler decoys, and I'm pretty positive they were $54 for two decoys, and actually took some pictures of some of the stuff. So yeah, so $50 for two decoys. For six regular floating pro grade greenhead gear decoys, $330. Now that's New Zealand dollars, but still.
So what's the exchange on that?
Pretty pricey. That's still got to be close to $200 ours.
Yeah, 200 pretty much on the dot.
So for a six pack
is $200. Wow.
Yeah. So, which, you know, I get the manufacturer, and then there's basically just this one, you know, it'd be like our Sportsman's Warehouse kind of. They've kind of, that's the only game in town for all these towns to go buy stuff so they could kind of set their prices. But still, it's like the stuff's coming from China. I don't see.
Is why ammo expensive too? Or is it just decoys and other stuff?
Well, I mean, like a box of Kent Fast Steel was like $49 for one box, but you know,
pretty
darn US dollars. It's yeah. I mean, it's kind of similar, but the decoys were the most outrageous by far. Decoys and duck calls. So like a duck commander call, you know, that was like $85.
Phew.
Yeah,
layers over there, you'll be rich. It's hard to get them in the U.S.
Well, I will say this. Almost everyone we hunted with had a layers.
Really? Did they know how valuable they are now?
Yeah, they all had, you know, hybrids and T1s and stuff. Jeff has an older layers that I think it's an A2 or whatever it is.
Cool. Like,
that one's worth money. You know, be careful of that one. Yeah.
Leave that one on the shelf.
Yeah, but no, they all, I wish I would have brought them some reeds or something, you know, but yeah, they all blow layers. And then there's a local person that's starting to make calls out there as well. There was a guy that made wood calls for a long time, Hammond, and he just recently passed away. But yeah, that was their main person prior to that.
So it sounds like on your trip, you guys did a mix of private and public, technically public hunting. What Is there like super good opportunity for people of New Zealand for, because obviously, you know, they come here and we show them like what a refuge is and it's just all these people. Do they have good opportunity there? I mean, you got to see some of it, but is there a lot of it out there for them if somebody was in New Zealand just wanted to go hunt?
I'd say yes and no. Like, I don't know. Not a ton.
Yeah, I mean, you can hunt all the waterways and things like that.
But they don't have like a refuge or like a duck management area?
Kind of small, though. Think of like one unit at Grizzly Ranch. That would be a huge parcel, right? Because we hunted one of those that was off of a bay that they have had for a number of years. But if you do ask permission from a landowner, they can't charge you. They can't ask you for payment.
But they can say so that's no. One,
they can say no, but they can't.
You
can't,
if they say
you can't
yes,
pay you.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah. So I couldn't go to a landowner and says, hey, I want to lease your cornfield for the duck season. That is illegal. You cannot do that.
I like that kind of.
Yeah. So there's definitely that. I would say, you know, there's a lot more opportunity than here for the public person. Well, not in terms of our refuges, but I mean, it's traditional where it's like, okay, that's public ground. I'm going to go hunt it. Something that they do have. So like when Colby and I, when we bought our license, it comes with your license card. And then they provide you a card for a MyMy claiming tag. So, you know, like in April, there's a date on it. If you had the MyMy last year, you have to tag it by a certain date. And then let's say if I was looking for a new place to hunt, I can go put my tag there or like on these public areas. There doesn't even have to be a blind there. You could just put a peg in the ground and affix this tag to it. And that's your spot. So basically on public property, you could have your personal blind and you would be able to hunt that blind. But if you're not there by 7 o'clock, anyone can hunt it. But let's say if you're there at 6:59, there's someone else in your spot, you would say, hey, this is my blind. You guys got to get out.
That's an interesting concept.
Yeah. So, you know, you'd be walking in some of these areas and be like, oh, wow, there's someone's pegging card, you know, blind thing. You'd be like, hey, do you know this person? Oh, yeah, kind of. I've never have ran into him. And you're like, this is a new permit. It's for 2025. But again,
so it's like other than... It's like a land claim, but not really up until basically 7 a.m. And then if you're not there, it's just invalid.
Yeah. But again, like people hunt on opener and then gone. Really don't come back for the most part, you know? So
that's a strange system.
Yeah. Which is kind of cool to think of it. It's like, you know, you could have a spot on public land that's yours, but you know, if you're not there, anyone could take advantage of the spot. So that was pretty different.
Yeah. Do you guys have a favorite moment from the trip that kind of sticks out?
What you got, Colby?
Besides eating all the delicious pies, I would say probably the first like actual prairie hunt that we did like in the field, like in the grass field, was probably my favorite part just because it was a perfect day, green field, like kind of on this hill. That had water on the backside. So you would shoot and they would get other birds up and it was just more like nonstop. You were just kind of like in an area.
Yeah.
And that was pretty fun.
Yeah, that was good. That was, you know, we're in layout blinds and they're all brushed well. And you know, the prairies were like landing on you. And it was just so quick, you know, so that was a good time. Man, we had some really good hunts with Jeff at his place. So that was kind of cool to see his spot and his blind and everything. It's an awesome place. He has his house and then you literally walk out the back and he's got a couple different ponds back there. He's got a, you know, basically a 3-story MyMy where it's like in the morning you could hunt down by the water and he's got some little stands there. Then you go up to the main level, which is in the middle, which has, you know, bunk beds and camping stove and all that good stuff. And then if the birds aren't working real well, you just walk up and there's a ladder and you get up on the roof as the top deck.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that was pretty cool. But,
yeah, he definitely had the best blind out of the whole place we've ever hunted.
Yeah. It was everything that you need. It was there. Like you could hunt all day because everything's there. Like you don't need anything else.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, God, there's so many really, really good memories, but overall, the Paradise Shell Duck Hunting was my favorite. They just decoy so well. They're a beautiful bird. They're a big bird, vocal. But yeah, you don't need a lot of stuff. I mean, we're hunting over like 24 silhouettes and they're just bombing it.
Not trailers full of snow goose decoys?
No. No, like Colby said, I mean, we hunted for Canada geese, I think we had maybe 12 honkers and a couple Perry decoys out, you know, and that was it.
I'm all for that.
Yeah. So
is there anything that you didn't get to do or anything that you would change about the trip that like you're already thinking of like, oh, if I were to go back next time, like I want to do this or I want to do this again or.
When it came to waterfowl hunting, I would say no. I didn't really have like big expectations. I didn't watch like a bunch of videos mm-hmm. to kind of see how they did it. I just went in with like kind of blind, you know, to just to kind of get the full experience. So
yeah,
I think when it came to waterfowl hunting, I got what I wanted, you know, felt pretty good.
Yeah, it's kind of the same. You know, just no expectations, you know, knowing that it'd be a little bit different than how we do things over here and what you see. But yeah, on the waterfowl front, if I ever went back, I mean, people are like us, like they want to shoot mallards or mallards or mallies or, you know,
Raylard.
That, yeah, that's what they want to shoot. But for me, I could have just shot paradise shell ducks every day and hunted those because you're hunting out of fields, which I love. They decoy, they're vocal, et cetera. Because it was hard for me because the mallards are so, I'm not going to say, yeah, they just look different than ours, right? It looks like an early season mallard, yeah, even like though
those
my
nasty ones you shoot in the northeast zone on like the opener, you're trying to figure out if it's a drake or a hen.
Yeah. So there's a lot more of those. Like we shot a couple nice drakes, but like even the bird in hand, there's a lot of little, just cosmetic stuff that's a little bit different than our mallards, which it doesn't feel like it's a mallard, if that makes sense. You know, their gray ducks though are super cool to shoot because they come in, they decoy really well and they're very different than their mallards. They come in whiffling and things like that. But yeah, on the duck front, I don't think there's anything else that, we missed. I would have liked to have shot Ellesmere just to say that you've hunted out there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it would have been nice, well, to go back, but like trying to see a fallow deer. We did see a really nice buck one day when we were trying to shoot pukekos. But definitely going back for some big game tar or chamois, I think, is on the list.
Do like a big game 2-week extravaganza with a couple waterfowl mixed in, kind of flip it around.
Yeah. I don't even know if I would duck hunt again, you know, maybe try to fish. Cause you just hear of, oh yeah, an average size brown trout is 8 to 10 pounds just right here in the middle of town.
Yeah.
You know, so
makes no sense.
No, but, even the ocean fishing
goose hunt would be cool again though. Like really getting into those things.
Like yeah. The Canada goose doing the little more.
Yeah, shoot.
Yeah, there's no limit on Canada geese. So they're a pest. So there's no limit. You can shoot them 24/7.
Did you guys just never rules. Have an opportunity? Like you just, I know you had the one goose hunt, but you just never were in the right spot with them.
Yeah, we just never really saw a whole lot. The last day we were there, we saw like a couple different groups, but yeah, there was never like a field where, I mean, if we saw 100 of them, you know, combined, I'd be shocked.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But you talk to guys like that will hunt out in a freshly cut cornfield and, you know, it's game on. But yeah, we didn't see any of that stuff kind of where we were at. And so it just, you know, didn't really happen. But I could see where that would be pretty awesome.
And, yeah, you get the right field and it's just, they keep coming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I mean, in that same field, you most likely are going to shoot parries, most likely will shoot mallards, and then all of the honkers too. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, no, it was definitely eye-opening. But I would say, you know, their diehard hunters are very much like ours, and just the way they do things, et cetera, you know, might be a little bit different, but they're into it, right? They're take care of their stuff. They got good gear. They have particular ways they like to do things, but yeah. Wouldn't mind doing some more big game hunting, but even ocean fishing, because there's no, the only regulations they have are for trout and salmon. But you don't need a fishing license to go off the coast and like go catch a marlin or a tuna.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's just so much opportunity. There's only so much time in a trip to be able to do everything, but you guys got to check a lot of stuff off the list and hopefully you'll make it back over there to do some more. But we're happy you're back with CWA and helping us out. Is there anything either of you want to leave us with before we log off for the day?
I think for me, I mean, if any of the New Zealand guys are watching, just thanks again. I had a great time, and thanks, you know, to Jeff and allowing me to go tag along with him as the older brother, and had a great time. It was a unique experience for sure.
Yeah, I want to second that. All of our hosts were amazing and just really went over above and beyond and hosting us and letting us into their homes and you know, feeding us traditional meals and things like that. That was really cool and fun. But no, it was an amazing experience. Learned a lot, I think, from just being over there. But yeah, I think, you know, just going into any hunting trip, which I've tried to do over my adult lifetime, and just, you know, don't set expectations, you know. And we had phenomenal hunts, shot some really, really cool places, like I said, and especially the South Island, where I don't think you get scenery like that anywhere else in the world that you'll waterfowl hunt. Definitely will cherish all those moments. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, duck hunters are duck hunters. Everyone is very like-minded. Everyone kind of thinks the same in terms of how we do things, why we do it. And there's definitely a huge passion for, you know, waterfowl hunting there. So, you know, we're excited to host some guys again this fall and keep the program going.
Good.
And yeah, just want to say thank you for everyone over there for hosting us. It was phenomenal.
Well, thank you guys. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on Save for the Blind podcast, and we will catch everybody on the next one. So thank you. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.